The headlines: Ukraine is calling on the civilian population in Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian forces close in on the city. Speculations growing about the imminent collapse of Boris Johnson's government amid several high-profile cabinet resignations. And also ahead, a 20-year-old Palestinian man becomes the latest victim of Israeli gunfire in the West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. In Ukraine, officials are calling on civilians in the eastern city of Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian troops continue to advance to secure the entire Donbass region. Slavyansk has become a new battleground just days after Russian troops took control of the neighboring Luhansk province. Local officials say Russian forces have been shelling the city chaotically over the past couple of days, mostly targeting civilian areas. The governor of Donetsk says the city is now within the range of Russian multiple rocket launchers. In an attack on Tuesday, at least two people were killed and seven others injured, some of them seriously. Russia consistently denies it targets civilians. Donetsk province is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. Together, Luhansk and Donetsk form the Donbass region, which has witnessed deadly conflict between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian groups in the past. Our Donetsk-based correspondent Johnny Miller says Ukrainian army is also shelling civilian areas across the Flashpoint Donbass region. Let's take a listen to the update on the situation there.
But in terms of the attacks on Donetsk, it's very clear that it's the Ukrainian army shelling Donetsk, where I am. Last week, a German channel put out a story saying it was Russia that was bombing Donetsk. They quickly had to retract that story. Interestingly, I saw yesterday the Daily Mirror newspaper in the UK absurdly reported that Russia, again, was attacking Donetsk, which is simply not the case. I think many of these journalists simply don't understand the complexities of this war. Many other mainstream outlets have got it correct, and that it is Ukraine shelling Donetsk. It's been happening for 3 days. There hasn't been much this morning, but the last 3 days, heavy shelling for most of the day. A 10-year-old girl was killed yesterday. Some shocking footage from her death, and every day the last few days there's been terror created around the city. The Ukrainians are clearly trying to target areas. I went to a market yesterday. They target markets. They're more likely for people to be there and to damage the civilian infrastructure in order to terrorize the people here and to hopefully to stop the people's support of the pro-Russian forces here. But that's been going on intermittently for the last 8 years. The people seem very resilient in supporting the pro-Russian forces. So there's a hope here. Some people I spoke to yesterday when I interviewed them, when they heard that I was British, they became very angry at me. Why? Because they know that NATO countries are supplying the Ukrainian army with these weapons. For example, the Scottish government has been forced by the British government to give £60 million in military aid to Ukraine. It's very important for people in NATO countries to recognize the simple fact that Ukraine uses some of their taxpayers' money to target and to kill civilians here in Donetsk, including, as I say, a 10-year-old girl. Yesterday, last week, I went to the funeral of a 6-year-old girl killed by that Ukrainian shelling. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have this information war. And indeed,
right,
almost no Western journalists have come to this part of Ukraine, because it's just a very uncomfortable fact of this war, that so much taxpayers' money is being spent to target and to kill civilians here in Donetsk.
Media reports and speculations growing about the imminent collapse of the government of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. That's amid resignations of Johnson's two cabinet colleagues and a party lawmaker from their posts. Johnson's finance and health secretaries quit on Tuesday, saying that they can no longer tolerate the culture of scandals that has rocked Downing Street for months. Sajid Javid and Rishi Sunak tendered their resignations minutes after Johnson apologized for keeping a former Conservative Party whip in his post despite being accused of sexual misconduct. Javid even questioned the Prime Minister's ability to govern in the national interest. Laura Trott, a Tory lawmaker, also stepped down from her role as Parliamentary Private Secretary to the Department of Transport. Johnson is in trouble less than a month after he survived a no-confidence vote On his leadership, Tory MP Andrew Bridgen says it's time for Johnson to go home, calling his latest scandal, quote, the icing on the cake. Robert Carter, of course, one is joining us now from the British capital, London. Robert, as you're joining us, we have breaking news. Two more ministers have resigned in a fresh blow to the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, rising the number of resignations to four. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. Well, obviously, the Prime Minister has faced a very turbulent 12 hours or so. With all these resignations, the message from his own party is very, very clear that they essentially have lost total confidence in the Prime Minister. However, there are still some loyalists hanging on, trying to keep things together for their Prime Minister. Now, Boris Johnson has worked tirelessly through the night to try and plug these gaps in his cabinet. And of course, he's appointed two loyalists, if you like, of his to take the key positions. So we've got Nadeem Zahawi taking over as Chancellor and Steve Barclay moving in as Health Secretary. Now, this is a very quick reshuffle, but it hasn't stopped the resignations, as you've just highlighted. So the question now is, what's going to happen next? There is huge pressure on the Prime Minister to basically give up and basically throw in the towel and give up his position. However, the Prime Minister has made absolutely clear in these initial signs that no, that is not something that he's looking to do. He's looking to hold on to power with everything that he has. So today is Prime Minister's Questions, which is where the Prime Minister will go up against the House. He's likely to be absolutely floored by the opposition leader Keir Starmer, who's going to have a field day attacking the Prime Minister, pushing for him to go. But also he might have some so-called friendly fire as again Conservative MPs in the back benches begin to undermine his leadership further by publicly announcing that they have lost confidence in him and that it's time for him to step down.
Thanks a lot, Robert Carter, joining us from the British capital, London. One more Palestinian falls victim to Israeli gunfire as the regime's forces intensify crackdowns in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 20-year-old Rafir Riyad Ghanam was shot during an Israeli raid on a village south of the city of Jenin. The victim was standing in front of his home when targeted and then detained along with another youth. Ghanam later succumbed to his injuries. Israeli forces carry out deadly raids in the occupied territories on almost a daily basis. The flashpoint city of Jenin has become a center of resistance in the wake of repeated attacks by Israeli settlers and forces there. Earlier, our correspondent Mona Kandil gave us more details on the latest deadly Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin.
I have to mention that the Israeli military declared that one of the main reasons for raiding Jenin is to arrest a well-known wanted Palestinian fighter. His name is Amid Arsan. He was a former Palestinian prisoner, and when he was released by the Israeli forces, he was wanted, and the Israeli military was also chasing him. They arrested him this morning, Amid Arsan, 24 years old, from Jenin. Not only this, what happened this morning, today we are speaking about over 40 Palestinians were detained, not only in Jenin, 30 of them were arrested by the Israeli forces in Silwad. And we have to say that Silwad, in the last few weeks, we have been witnessing the clashes and more, let's say, anti-Israel operations being carried out by Palestinians also originally from Silwad. So the main aim for the Israeli military today is to continue raiding the areas where the homeland of Palestinians who carried out anti-Israel operations or are engaged in the different forms of resistance like Jenin and Silwad today.
Iran's foreign minister says an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal is only based on mutual understanding and interests of all sides. Hossein Amir Abdollahian once again voiced Iran's readiness to negotiate a strong and durable agreement. He criticized the U.S. for its inability to make a decision during the negotiations. Amir Abdollahian said, if the U.S. wants a deal, it must stop insisting on its unilateral demands. His remarks came after Tuesday phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Borrell tweeted that the parties to the JCPOA revival talks must make decisions now if they want an agreement. The talks were stalled for more than 3 months over excessive demands put forth by the U.S. Well, the Qatari foreign minister is scheduled to arrive in Tehran in the coming hours for talks with Iranian officials. According to the foreign ministry, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Jassim al-Thani is set to hold talks with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian. They discuss bilateral relations as well as regional and international issues. The visit comes a week after Doha hosted the EU-mediated indirect talks between Tehran and Washington over the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. And July 6 marks the anniversary of an airstrike on a wedding ceremony in eastern Afghanistan. The attack killed 47 civilians, including the bride. Rahmatullah Baban reports from Kabul.
On July 6, 2008, a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province turned a wedding into carnage. These people were with the bride to the groom's house when they were hit by the U.S. missiles. The attack left 47 Afghan civilians dead, including women and children. 14 years on, relatives of the victims said they are still grieving their losses in what they call a horrific and unjustified attack.
It was the wedding of son of Xarin in August village. Around 5 in the morning, our relatives were escorting the bride to the groom's house when they were hit by 3 back-to-back airstrikes. It was a very shocking incident.
The attack stoked anger among Afghans. At that time, the Afghan government tasked a group of lawmakers, experts, with investigating the incident. A member of that group says that all of the victims were civilians. He says no U.S. military personnel were punished for killing.
The U.S. bombarding the bride's caravan was a huge tragedy and a humanitarian catastrophe. Dozens of innocent Afghans were killed or wounded. Unfortunately, the U.S. Air Force personnel involved in that attack were not probed. The Afghan people were asking why the U.S. should kill women, men and children at a wedding. But the U.S. didn't even respond to the questions. Then, Afghan government also failed to hold the U.S. forces accountable since they were puppets of the West.
After decades of war on Afghanistan, the U.S. and allies hastily abandoned the country in August 2021. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, night raids, and mass killings. The 20-year invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S. has left Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People here say they will neither forget nor forgive the U.S. crimes, its rights violations in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The South Korean president warns of stern retaliation in case of any provocative behavior by North Korea. Yoon Suk-yeol issued the warning during a meeting with top military commanders amid reports that Pyongyang is preparing a new nuclear test. Yoon, who took office in May, has also called for boosting capabilities to deter North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. The North is in a long-running dispute with South Korea and Japan, as well as the United States. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense in the face of U.S.-led threats. Washington and its allies want the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and have slapped a wave of sanctions on North Korea. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith says the South Korean warning followed the arrival of U.S. stealth fighter jets in the country as a newly elected president is seeking to boost ties with Washington.
Have a change in government here. Yoon Suk-yeol is the new president. He's a conservative, and he's vowed to take a hard line with North Korea. During the campaign, you know, he just was sworn in May. During the campaign for the election, He suggested that South Korea bring in more terminal high-altitude area defense. That's THAAD. That's an American anti-ballistic missile system. He's also vowed to strengthen the alliance between South Korea and the U.S. This week, the U.S. flew in something like six F-35 Joint Strike Fighters to take part in Air Force exercises with the South Korean military. Yoon has promised to take, again, a hard line with North Korea. He visited Spain for a NATO summit, the first South Korean president to visit a NATO summit to again strengthen other countries' support for his hardline with North Korea.
Thousands more people flee their homes as rain-triggered floods continue to wreak havoc in Australia's New South Wales. Emergency services have issued more than 100 evacuation orders since torrential rains hit the country's east coast over the weekend. Floodwaters have already submerged communities, roads, and bridges in Australia's largest city, Sydney. Authorities have issued fresh alerts north of the city, citing the danger of rain-swollen rivers. They've ordered more than 80,000 people to evacuate. As the meteorology department says, the weather system is expected to move off later this week. More than 20 people have lost their lives since the flooding started in March. The government says a disaster in urban areas has pushed insurance claims to over 2,700 in Sydney alone. Sudanese protesters reject a claim by the country's coup leader that he's making way for civilian rule, calling it a, quote, transparent maneuver. Sudan's main civilian bloc, the Forces for Freedom of Change, has called for more protests, dismissing Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's move as a giant ruse. On Monday, Burhan vowed to make room for civilian groups to form a new transitional government. The announcement came 8 months after the coup ousted civilians tasked with forming an interim administration, sparking widespread international condemnations. Sudanese have been demanding the return of civilian rule, and hundreds of anti-coup demonstrators are continuing their sit-ins in capital Khartoum. The African nation is in the grip of unrest since the ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir back in 2019 and a subsequent military coup. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
During the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold, says Andrea Mazzarino Ryder in an article published under the heading Arm to the Teeth, America Has an Anger Problem. Stay tuned for more. Increasingly, it seems, Americans have an anger problem. All too many of Americans now have the urge to use name-calling, violent social media posts, threats, baseball bats, and guns to do what they once did with persuasion and voting. For example, during the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold. And too often, the call to violence seems to come from the top. Recently, the defendants in cases involving extremist violence have claimed that an elected leader or pundit told them to do it. In a country where a sitting president would lunge at his own security detail in rage, we guess this isn't so surprising anymore. Emotion rules the American political scene, and so many now tend to shoot from the hip without even knowing why. Increasing number of Americans, however, respond to the growing extremity of the moment by avoiding the latest headlines and civic engagement, fearful that some trauma will befall them even by witnessing the news. As a psychotherapist who works with veterans and military families, an expert often speaks with folks who have decided to limit their news intake or have stopped following the news altogether. Repeated mass shootings in places ranging from schools to houses of worship, combined with increased visibility and influence of militias at theoretically peaceful demonstrations, can be more scaring than the wounds soldiers once sustained in combat zones. According to the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, 45 state legislatures in the U.S. have considered 230 bills that would criminalize the threat of violent leftist or black protest. And sadly enough, far-right activists are anything but a fringe minority movement as they challenge the very idea of peaceful elections and public protests that aren't theirs. To be sure, left-wing violence and combative rhetoric is a thing in this country, the United States, albeit a small one. The shooting of a Trump supporter by an Antifa protester in Portland, Oregon, during a Black Lives Matter demonstration in August 2020 is the lone example of a lethal attack by that left-wing group or other anti-fascists over the past 25 years. Of the 450 murders by political extremists during the last decade, approximately 4% of them were committed by left-wing groups and about 75% by right-wing, white supremacist, anti-government ones. So, what are Americans to do? As a start, given where the Trumpist movement and much of the Republican Party seems to be heading, Americans really need to do something, almost anything. As Michigan Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson, a Democrat, pointed out, facing the growing crisis on the right, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders than what we experienced in 2018 when party vigilance was significant enough, but not nearly what was needed, unquote. A headline of an article in the satirical online newspaper The Onion caught the mood of the moment among progressives. Left-wing group to disorganize for FBI agents to infiltrate. In it, a fictional FBI agent says, "These people don't ever do anything violent. They don't ever do anything at all." Recently, a local Democratic candidate in Maryland knocked on doors seeking name and contact information as a possible volunteer for his campaign. It turned out, however, he wasn't even carrying a pen or paper. Ironically, one government institution that has at least made a nod toward countering right-wing violence is the U.S. military. Since the January 6 attacks, the Department of Defense under Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has acknowledged an increase in domestic extremist violence carried out by active duty or reserve service members. In response, he initiated a multi-pronged strategy to screen new recruits, educate military personnel about extremism, and begin investigating extremist activity within the ranks. As partisan rhetoric heats up in the United States, progressives are guilty of focusing too hard on the most politicized identity issues, however valuable or even whatever. Asini behavior ignites behaviors and airwaves at a given moment, be it Trump's QAnon-style conspiracy mongering or ex-New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's groping. The problem is that as the Trumpists ramp up their anger, if progressives don't find a unifying message of community and love and find it soon, the guns already out there may be put to use in unspeakable ways. Progressives would do well to step back and think about the genuine big tent issues, like how to show everyone from white suburban women to rural farmers to black single parents that they have so much to lose in life if Americans don't have a government willing to continue regulating healthcare and doing so in a far better fashion. They would gain so much if, in this all too angry country of Americans, they could focus their attention on the importance of childcare for every family who needs it. Above all, if they could focus in an intense way on the ever more dangerous world they're living in, that would be a positive. Whether or not they agree on what's causing global warming, it's hard not to agree right now that they're living in an ever hotter, ever more drought-stricken, ever more extreme America. Why can't agree that it's already damn hot and the summer's just beginning?
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A Bank of England report warning the economic outlook for the UK and the rest of the world has deteriorated materially. It calls the British economy very uncertain. British households have been paying more for energy, food and fuel recently, mainly due to the economic fallout of the Ukraine war. Now, experts believe that the inflation rate in Britain could surpass 11% later this year. Elsewhere in Europe, powerhouse Germany posting a monthly trade deficit for the first time in three decades. Germany's Federation of Trade Unions has warned that the short supply can lead to the collapse of entire industries if it remains unresolved. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi. We're going to discuss the fallout of the Ukraine war in Europe. Joining me in this episode will be historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Tony, beginning with you, to what extent has the Ukraine war contributed to rising energy prices and the cost of living crisis in Europe?
Well, I can't really speak for Europe. I can certainly speak for the UK. And I'm not so sure that the Ukraine war has contributed much. What has contributed is the excessive, relentless sanctions being piled on Russia from the West. And this has made, obviously, a big difference in confidence. So as soon as you get a government saying, oh, we're not going to be trading with this part of the world, what happens is it has a knock-on effect on all your various businesses, not just the lack of actual trade, because, of course, there is still trade going on between Russia and Europe in terms of the fuel, which is still going, the gas, which is still going. These are the major things. I think what's the main problem here is these new green taxes which they've been implementing at the same time. We were told here in the UK and across Europe and the United States back in the last autumn 2021, we were told there's going to be a big hike in gas prices and fuel prices, but we weren't told why. Now we know. And I would suggest that they knew that the conflict in Ukraine was going to break out way back in 2021, and that actually over Christmas, what we saw here was a new green tax. I would call it a fascist green tax, a green fascist tax put onto petrol and diesel here in Britain, an extra 20 pence a litre. What happened is the oil companies raised their prices before Christmas, and when the new tax came in over Christmas, they dropped their prices so that no one would notice the new tax. This is the BPs and the Shells doing this. And so this has, I think, been the main driver of inflation. And of course, this, what it does is it really makes it much more difficult for the small and medium businesses to survive. They're having to pay more and more just to get around. So if you put, I mean, this is one basic thing of economics which doesn't seem to have got through to the British politicians or the finance journalists in London. For obvious reasons, is that they don't like to upset the finance people in London, the journalists. It is that you, what you've done is you've increased everything. By increasing the price of fuel, you increase the price of almost everything. Goods, manufactured goods, services, food, all has to be distributed. So you're adding on to the price of that by increasing the cost of fuel. And I think that's the main driver behind this. Rather than the actual Russian action. What they're trying to do, as they always do, is to blame somebody else for their own problems. I think the biggest question in all of this has got to be why these enormous sanctions have been put onto Russia because of what was actually the Russian intervention in a civil war, which the NATO countries had been fueling for many years. Victoria Nuland in the United States pouring $5 billion into seeing the coup in 2014, for example. She admitted to that herself. So there was a civil war which was started over in the Ukraine, and the attempt has been to blame all of the problems which are being put onto the West, domestic populations in Europe, the United States, and here in Britain, an attempt to blame this on Russia, because they simply will not admit that what they're doing is damaging their own people.
Okay. Now, John Bosnich, I just wanted to ask you about, let's take a look at the bigger picture. Let's see how this Ukraine war has impacted Europe as a whole. Then we'll come to Britain and then later on to Germany and others.
Okay, well, I mean, we know already, and I appreciate the comments of your other guest, Tony Gosling, because he's right on the money here. Every war is an opportunity to camouflage another domestic problem. And so this is correct. It's an opportunity for the English government and for European governments to blame Russia for unsolved infrastructure problems within their own economies. Mm-hmm. And no better than to blame it now on Russia than to have to try and explain to the public that you made a mistake yourselves. So right. That's a correct starting point. But on the longer term, what we're seeing here is that this war represents a shift in power globally. And this is the actual end of the line for the make war and take over countries approach that the United States, the so-called Anglo-American Empire, has been pursuing since Britannia ruled the waves. We have a situation here where there's either going to be devastating nuclear war, not two nuclear bombs like World War II, but a devastating nuclear war that's going to change the face of the planet, or there's going to be cooperation between nations in our common interest. And this has been forced upon us by the American push, with the support of England, with the support of London and the military regime there, and the military regime, and I call them both military regimes, because basically the number one business of the Anglo-American Empire is war. Everything else is just feeding the people while we prepare for the next war. Mm-hmm. This is the turning point. Are we going to pursue an economic plan for the world based on taking from other people or based on sharing technologies and working together for the future? That's where we are today.
Okay, interesting. Now, Tony, let's take a look at Britain now. The cost of living crisis, together with the rising inflation, has taken a heavy toll on the economy, as you know. And there is this new report that's painting an even darker picture for the country's economic situation. So what do you anticipate is awaiting British economy?
Well, the signs are not good. Of course, there will be an attempt to blame all this on Brexit, as the British economy has its problems. I've seen the people fighting back here. We saw just yesterday, in the beginning of July 2022, we saw lorry drivers blockading. What they're doing is they're driving very slowly along motorways. They're not actually making sure that nobody can move anywhere, that they're making the point by driving slowly together on all three lanes of the motorway, or two lanes together, that people are not going to put up with these fuel price hikes. And actually what's going on, of course, is what the oil cartels have been trying to do for many decades. Governments have been reining them back and trying to stop them doing this, which is simple. It's called price fixing. The fact is that the oil cartels have become so powerful, and actually they are some of the wealthiest businesses or in any institutions, in some ways more wealthy than governments. They've got more money to throw around than the governments do. Is that they're now using that power to do things like restrict the supply, as they did last autumn here in Britain. And so what's happening is there is a bit of a fight back going on from ordinary people getting together and telling the government that we know you've got a very powerful oil lobby. We are people and we are a lobby too, so listen to us. But the prospects are not good here in Britain or in other parts of Europe. And as you mentioned at the start, this is very shocking to see the Germans return their first for many, many years trade deficit. So that means that the Germans are importing more than they're exporting. Mm-hmm. Germany, let's not forget, is the manufacturing hub of Europe. So what we're seeing is the geopolitical plates shifting, tectonic plates completely changing. So the pattern that's been building up since the Second World War is now changing, a bit like something as important as the fall of the Berlin Wall. The prospects in Britain are not good, and I think we need to understand why that is. And the reason is because we have adopted this Anglo-Zionist Empire attitude of finance capitalism. That is to say, money rules the world, and the people with the money make all the decisions. They have the power to keep their money offshore, for example, so it doesn't get taxed, and they can accumulate more and more. And when they start to become billionaires, then they set up these foundations, tax-free foundations, so they can funnel the money into those and use those for political change and propaganda. Basically, think places like the Wellcome Trust, the Bill and Melinda, the finance sector needs to be very strongly regulated or owned. Things like water, also we have, telecommunication monopoly. These things need to be controlled by openly and publicly. And we're also talking gas and electricity industries, countries like Russia and many others around sovereign countries going to keep control of these. And the person who's made this fight between finance capitalist countries and industrial has got to be the American economist Michael Hudson. By the way, he Chinese universities too. So this is well understood, completely shut out by the London and by the finance journalists. At some point, they will start getting educated on this and that. What we're fighting, because of course we are fighting this within Britain as well. We don't want taken over and controlled individuals. We want control and own them for them.
Okay, John, let's take a look at Germany now. You know, the rare deficit in Germany is blamed on international supply chains and record energy prices, and this is said to be partially triggered by Russia's cutting back on, supplying natural gas to Europe. And Germany relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas needs. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that it is in part a fuel shortage issue, but these countries have strategic reserves, and the conflict in Ukraine has not been going on long enough to deplete the strategic reserves of Germany. So we have a more complex problem here than simply a supply and demand problem. What we have here is a general refocusing of the economic center of this planet. And this has been going on for some time now, but the economic motor force of this planet has already shifted to China. It is no longer Germany. Germany is still the motor center of the economy of Europe. And when Germany shows a deficit, that means that the entire Europe is going to be going down the tubes economically shortly. So those who wish to survive will be turning to China. They will be turning to China for cheaper quality, cheaper goods with similar quality. China will be able to outproduce Germany. China has already licensed large elements of German productive capacity. Germany has sold these licenses to China, and China has factories that have supply of fuel, a steady, stable supply of fuel from Russia directly by pipeline. And this is going to be the tipping factor that's going to tip the scales away from Europe as the center of the world. And it won't be so long, you know, our grandchildren, if not our children, will be looking at atlases of the world in which Europe is no longer the center. Europe will be on one edge, America and South America will be on the other edge, and the Eurasian landmass centering around Russia, India, and China will be at the center of every world map. This is just the start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we talked about problems, gentlemen. Tony, let's now take a look at ways we could resort to address the economic woes in Europe. Slapping sanctions on top of sanctions on Moscow, which pushes Russia to take more tit-for-tat measures, is that the way?
Well, actually, Russia has been quite good in not taking tit-for-tat measures. They have done with their diplomats over the years, but the Russians are doing everything they can. They're bending over backwards to have decent relations with the West. They have understood that there's been 15,000 people killed in the Donbass region in Ukraine, which is why they felt it necessary to intervene over the last 8 years. And that aspect of this isn't really covered at all in the Western media. So the Russians, I think, have not been just taking one measure for another. They're seeing this as something where, okay, so if the West wants to play these games, and I think actually the West, by the way, if you want to look it up, is using game theory here, that what they're doing is they're saying, let's imagine having a war game about this and who can win and who can't. And they're following these ideas, economic warfare and military warfare games, in order to try and beat the Russians, almost like using a chess computer or something, this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, the populations are watching all of this, and they're seeing the credibility of the West slide down. So, I think that the Russians have been much more mature, and the Chinese, in many ways, just simply taking what the West has been trying to do without big retaliation. That's because, of course, they are winning the economic war, if you want to see it like that. They have a very strong natural resource bases. They have a very good and efficient, well-regulated economy where and manufacturing bases where individuals can actually get access to new people starting in the market. What we've got in the West is basically a series of rackets or cartels that are controlling industries, are price fixing. And, you know, this is really the way that big empires go down. And we're seeing that, of course, with the United States. Slowly but surely, countries around the world are realizing, well, we cannot trust putting our money into Washington or London because then it may well be seized. So that money is slowly but surely, and that wealth is moving around the world mm-hmm. to these new power centers that John was talking about, away from Washington. And the Anglo-Zionist Empire is basically shooting itself in the foot by having such a ridiculous overreaction. That overreaction is aimed at its domestic population. But I don't think necessarily that that propaganda is going to work in the long term. It's really a desperate measure. And I think it indicates just how desperate the deep state, the ruling elite in the West now is.
Okay. John, let me ask you a question about the U.S. and then if we have time, another I'll put in a question to Tony about Europe. Now, President Biden blaming Russia for the rising fuel price in the U.S. and so far his earmark, you know, $7 billion of American taxpayer money, you know, into aiding Ukraine fight Russia. Does he intend to see an end to this bloodshed and destruction that's happening in Ukraine and love life on both sides, or does he have another agenda on his mind?
Well, you know, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And all America has now is a military. That's what they've got to offer to the world, military intervention. So they are hoping that by stacking the cards against Russia, by dumping their latest weapons into the hands of untrained Ukrainians, many of whom do not want to fight, they think that they can defeat the Russian army when it's come to right the wrongs after 8 straight years, as Tony mentioned, 8 straight years of genocide against ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Well, they're absolutely wrong. And if the shoe were on the other foot, they would understand it. But nobody does to America what America does to the rest of the world. So they don't understand that when you're backed into a corner, when you're facing the prospect of nuclear weapons just minutes away from your capital city, when you've got the prospect of armies full of Nazis wearing World War II uniforms and swastikas at your borders, you have only one possible response, and that is to eliminate them. And that's what Russia is doing. And as Russia eliminates this forward front of the American military empire, they realize that where they are in those other countries, because of the same system that is failing America, failing the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, and failing the puppet comedian president every day in Ukraine. The Ukrainian people themselves are smarter than this, and they are going to stop it. They will probably remove Zelensky themselves.
Okay, Tony, we have almost 1 minute. If you could tell me briefly, would Europe be better off by further offering military and logistical aid to Kiev to keep fighting Russia, or rather by striving to encourage and facilitate dialogue between the two belligerent sides?
Well, look, of course, Europe would be far better off if we could see some sort of a peace deal in like the Minsk agreement in Ukraine. But it doesn't look as if the United States is going to allow Europe to do that, because, of course, we must understand that most of the force behind NATO is a United States force. Worth remembering, of course, that there were a couple of people involved, one specifically whose name escapes me. These are the leaders of NATO after the Second World War who had actually been in the SS during the war, Nazi leaders taking over as NATO leaders. So, of course, the Russians realize exactly who they're dealing with. But when it comes to what Europe should do, yes, of course, there should be a peace agreement. But I think many people in Britain are watching this battle going on a long way away and just wondering, what on earth does Boris Johnson think he's doing, trying to fight somebody else's war in another part of the world when he's leaving his own people struggling to even feed their children? This is a message which is going down here. And, of course, as I said, what we're seeing is more and more pushback, more and more people out on the streets and out on the roads actually protesting against this policy. So it may be that it's down to the British people to turn around this crazy government idea of carrying on with this war, because peace in Ukraine would mean a fantastic benefit for the whole of Europe, And all right. That's, I'm afraid, against the interests of the United States, and that's where we are. Europeans need to really get, I think, grow a pair and really start to stand up to the United States. We do not want, and we refuse to have, a U.S. war on European soil, thank you very much. We're not going to put up with that.
Okay, and that's all the time we have. Tony Gosling in Brussels, John Bosnich in Belgrade, thank you so much for the contribution and insight.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wassalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee, and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice-regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الضعيف من لم يرفع إليه حجة ولم يعرف الاختلاف فإذا عرف الاختلاف فليس بضعيف.
Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام stated, the weak person is one whom the divine proof has not reached and who would not be able to differentiate even if it did reach him. If he is able to differentiate between truth and falsehood, therefore, then he is not considered weak.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about these beautiful dialogues and conversations of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence spoke about such beautiful concepts in his dialogues. In one such instance, we find that when Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was talking about work and how we need to make the best out of our work with his companions, his companion asked, what kind of work should one undertake and what kind of work should one not undertake? Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam said to his companion, whoever undertakes that which is not his work is lost and they are disappointed. It is interesting, but here we find that surely undertaking something which is not our work, meaning something that we don't have a specialization in, something that we are not comfortable with, or something that we are not aware of, or, for example, something that, as I said, is not our specialization, we will most probably end up messing up that kind of work. And when we mess up that work, of course, we find that the work ends up being lost, it becomes wasted, and of course, one is in return disappointed. And so really, we should try our best to do work which is related to our fields, right? And perhaps sometimes a situation might come up where we cannot avoid a certain type of task, even though we are not an expert in it. Well, in that kind of situation, you try your best to acquire the sufficient knowledge in order to be able to do that work comfortably and do that work correctly and appropriately and to the best of our efforts. But otherwise, we should be very careful in not doing work which we are not specialized to be doing. Just one very quick example. It seems like we're talking about religious things all the time, and we consider ourselves to be experts of religious matters. We kind of throw our own individual fatwas, our own individual jurisprudential rulings on anything that we want. The religious aspect and the religious fear and the sphere of the rules and regulations of Islam is a sphere which is under the expertise of experts, religious experts, and we should refer to them when it comes to religious injunctions and not try to undertake a work which is not our expertise. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. It is evident from my reading that the imam knew of this. He intentionally took those positions. He intentionally provoked the government. In other words, he spoke in a way that he knew was going to be leading to his imprisonment. This is what I mean. Not that he wanted them to imprison him, meaning he did, al-ayadu billah, activities. He was involved with activities that he did